This is The Full Story. I'm Rebecca Saran in for Ron Ropiak. We're right in the middle of summer. The days are long, the nights are warm, but it won't last. If you're searching for ways to enjoy the summer of 2019 before it fades away into fall, today's show is designed to give you some ideas. Last week, Connecticut Governor Ned Lamont took a tour of some of the state's popular attractions. A state-commissioned report says 2017 marked 8 straight years of growth in the tourism industry, and that's the most recent year studied. The report says tourism generated nearly $1 billion in state and local taxes. Two of Lamont's stops were the Maritime Aquarium in Norwalk and the Beardsley Zoo in Bridgeport. So joining me now is Tina Tyson. She is the Director of Marketing at the Maritime Aquarium, and Greg Dancho, Zoo Director at the Beardsley Zoo. Welcome to you both.
How are you
doing? Hey, welcome. Yeah, thank you very much for having us.
All right, let's talk a little bit about the governor's visit. Tina, I'll start with you. How important is it that the governor made his round to the, visiting the state's most popular tourist attractions?
You know, we were thrilled. There is so much energy right now within the state around tourism and arts and culture. And the governor made a commitment during his transition from governor-elect to governor to have a committee focused on that. So it was great to be included as one of his stops because it just... He had a lot of options. We have a lot of tourist attractions within the state. So for him to spend the time with us was a real honor and just is a continuation of the positive energy around tourism and highlighting everything the state has to offer.
You know, Greg, what about you? This was exciting, having the governor come in person, taking a tour of the zoo.
Yeah, and if he hadn't been there for quite a while, and that seems to be a case of a lot of people who have had children, young children, and come to the zoo, but as the children grow up, it's something they haven't come to for a while. So it was great to show them around, show them all the things that have happened in the last, 20 years at the zoo, the improvements, the increased attendance, increased educational programming, all the things that we do. Not only for our guests and our animals, but also for students and youngsters to learn about conservation and environmental programs. So it was great to have him there. He's Dan Malloy was actually the first sitting governor to come visit the zoo a few years ago. So having a governor come back in such a recent event is good for the zoo. It's also good for the region. And having the governor do this tour around the state of Connecticut, looking at the attractions and our really varied institutions, is good for him to get his eyes opened. As you just mentioned a few minutes ago, the whole idea here is tourism is a huge economic driver for the state of Connecticut, and it really needs more support. And I think if we talk to every institution in the state of Connecticut that does this type of programming, we need more help.
And
so having them there to see what we're doing, and go down to the Maritime Aquarium and see what they're doing. Within a 20-minute drive, you're seeing something that impacts hundreds of thousands of people.
And Tina, I mean, it's very important the state stands behind these attractions, isn't it? I mean, $1 billion business.
Yeah, I mean, from a revenue perspective, absolutely. Because tourism, the more the state identifies it and recognizes it and embraces it as a key economic driver, it just makes sense. But on an individual attraction basis, many of us are nonprofits. And we rely on the support of individuals and of businesses and from other funding within the state. So any support that we have financially as well as culturally is that's what keeps our lights on. That's what helps us do what we do. And as Greg referred to, it's not just about the day-to-day visitors or the members. It's about what we're doing in the areas of research and conservation and education. So we not only bring money into the state, but we bring a lot of strong programming to the residents here and to visitors from out of state. So all the support is so incredibly important to us.
And Greg, Tina brings up something that's important, the out-of-state visitor. I know there have been some adorable billboards on I-95 that have been terrific. Yeah, they catch my eye every time. But how difficult is it maybe to bring in out-of-staters to these attractions?
It's an interesting observation because we get quite a few out of state, especially in Westchester County, coming into the zoo. We track that through our gate, and we see quite a few people coming in. It's the local attendance sometimes the hardest to get because it's so close that you just don't go. So our marketing, even though, as Tina just mentioned, the dollars we need is also in marketing. The state of Connecticut a few years ago decided not to market the state at all. We all got hit really, really hard by that. So as a holistic program, when we're in our marketing, which is limited dollars, and the Maritime Aquarium's doing their marketing, which is limited dollars, to have no support from the upper levels of the state through tourism, it makes a big impact. The state tourism board is looking to bring people from out of state. That is one of their missions. So the more funding that they can have and the more funding they can use to bring those guests in help is very helpful. But again, we see it's pretty strong. People use the Merritt Parkway for the Maritime Aquarium and the zoo. They use that thoroughfare coming into the state to visit us pretty good. We still get that same. It's really strange, and for most people, I may not even remember, but they think of Connecticut and us as still going into the country, mm-hmm. and then taking the Merritt Parkway, we're going to the country. It's like the old I Love Lucy show, I guess, when they moved from the city into the country. And I still get that from people. It's a nice drive into Connecticut. Traffic, well, we won't get into that right now.
Mm. But in the tri-state area, you're going to encounter traffic wherever you travel to.
Mm-hmm. Exactly right.
Tina, how did the Maritime Aquarium offset that cut from the state in marketing funding?
I don't know that we fully offset the entirety of it. It's forced us and people like me in the marketing role to be much more creative about the dollars we do have. It make our dollars go as far as possible. So we've partnered with some organizations so that instead of paying for advertising, we get exposure on a partner type basis, almost like a barter type arrangement. We've tried to get very creative about how we use our own assets. So email databases, that it's not a traditional paid advertising, that it's something that we own and we can control without spending traditional ad dollars. So we've tried to utilize things like that to have the kind of loaves and fishes sort of strategy, that what little we have it extend as far as possible. But at the end of the day, it truly has not offset all the marketing dollars that were originally supporting the state and supporting the region versus what we have today.
And both of these attractions have been with us in the state of Connecticut for a long time.
Yeah, Greg far longer than I. Or Greg's institution far longer than
that's
I.
Well, I'm not even sure about that now. I'm going on my 40th year of working at the zoo, so it's...
Well, congratulations. That's something to be proud of. The zoo itself, though, in 2022, celebrating its 100th anniversary. That is reason to celebrate.
Mm-hmm. That is resonating.
And the Maritime Aquarium, even though it started as the Maritime Center, I think.
Yeah.
More than 30 years.
Yep, exactly right. We just are celebrating this month our 31st anniversary. So again, we're not at the triple digits like Beardsley, but it says a lot. And especially in a city like Norwalk, or Greg, maybe you can confirm with Bridgeport as well. At the time we were built, the city of Norwalk was really in a state of transition. And though there was a strong commitment that a maritime center, an offering to the community that featured both live exhibits and at the time boating exhibits, that would be a draw. It was a calculated risk. You know, it was Sona was fairly run down mm-hmm. at the time. So we're very proud, although again not quite the milestone that the Beardsley's approaching. Mm-hmm. We're really proud 31 years later to say that yes, we have survived, we have thrived, we have hopefully been part of a positive transition within the city. city and a draw within the state and to people coming into the state. So it's every year that an attraction survives is a important thing to celebrate.
And that's the challenge, isn't it, Greg? I mean, here facing 100 years, keeping it fresh, mm-hmm. recognizing how generations yeah. change, what they're interested yeah. in. How do you assess that and then pivot to accommodate those changes?
If you don't look at the business as an evolutionary, and that's pun intended, process, then really you're going to miss the ball. And for our facility, we've transitioned over the last 100 years from being a menagerie to just having animals coming in for people to just gawk at to now being a conservation and environmental mm-hmm. institution. We're more educational than just about anything else. People do come to the zoo to have fun, and our four pillars are conservation, education, recreation, and research. Recreation always is that component because people still come out to have a good time. But really, we've transitioned into that conservation and education role very, very strongly. And there's a bunch of reasons for that. One is that it's the right thing to do. Both of us are dealing with environments that are critically endangered. The inhabitants are even more critically endangered. We are dealing with people that need to know that these things are happening, and where you're going to get your information. It's best to get it firsthand. We do a lot of social media work. We know the internet is a powerful tool, but as Tina mentioned before, you don't want to distract too much. You want them to see the things that we're doing, and we want them to learn from that. So to come see an Amur tiger or our Amur leopard cubs, which are the most endangered species of cat on the planet, is critical for them to look into those animals' eyes and know that humans can be the cause of these things leaving us. Mm-hmm. And we also can be the cause of these animals staying with us. So to me, that's really the transition we've made over time. We're not in the business just to have people come in and buy popcorn and look at animals. Mm-hmm. We are here for multitudinous reasons.
All right, we're going to continue our conversation with Tina Tyson from the Maritime Aquarium and Greg Dancho from the Beardsley Zoo in just a moment. And we're back talking with Tina Tyson. She's the Director of Marketing at the Maritime Aquarium in Norwalk, and Greg Dancho, Zoo Director at the Beardsley Zoo. It's the summertime. It's time for residents in Connecticut and beyond to come to the state and enjoy all the state has to offer when it comes to tourism. We were talking, Tina, before we went to the break. How important is that for the Maritime Aquarium mm-hmm. to make those visitors recognize we're here for a very short time? Mm-hmm. It's our responsibility to care for the planet. Mm-hmm. And this is more on how you can do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's incredibly important because we all know that we as individuals, we can do something. But it still is not top of mind on a day-to-day basis for many people that small actions can have a big result, positive or negative. So it's very important to us just as a community entity to mm-hmm. remind people of that, but especially because of our mission. As Greg so eloquently described, our individual animals, the habitats from which they, originate are in many cases very vulnerable and at risk. So we take it a step further. We've integrated it at all touch points, the message of conservation. So if you're viewing a live animal exhibit, we have signage and individual staff members talking about positive changes that are happening there, individual actions that anyone can take to help. But then organizationally, we have long eliminated single-use plastic. So mm-hmm. from gift shops and our cafe, we were almost a year ahead of the city of Norwalk and other organizations for eliminating straws. And that's not a criticism of them. It's just more of how into the future we were thinking of those types of actions. Our films that we show in the IMAX theater all echo that within all of our education programs. So I don't think there is a touch point that we have that is not communicating that message either by what we're saying or what's available or what's unavailable. But again, that's just the beginning. And I think within the world of conservation and those types of initiatives, you almost can't go too far. So I think we are doing a lot. But I think moving forward, whether it's next week, next month, next year, et cetera, you'll see us do even more.
The new role or the evolving role that locations like the aquarium and the zoo have, there's also a whole research component. Mm-hmm. You share the conservation, but there's a research staff. Mm-hmm. How do you make that interesting for kids?
That's a good question. I think kids, it's almost easier to make it interesting for kids than it is sometimes for adults. Kids have such a natural curiosity. They love to learn. They love to be hands-on. So sometimes, you know, showing them what we're doing in a laboratory or showing them a hands-on program that involves research or the immediate result of research, it's kind of an easier sell with younger ones than with us older folks.
They're not jaded.
They're not jaded. They don't glaze over with the flashbacks of school. So there is a natural curiosity that we can tap into. But, you know, ultimately, it's about the learnings that you get from it. So research for research's sake is always harder to make a connection with anyone, regardless of age. But when we can bring all of our learnings to life. So one of the programs that we've been involved with for years is the Unified Water Study. And it's exactly what it sounds like. We regularly go out and test the water in Long Island Sound and study it for health and quality of organisms and things like that. And in doing that, we've been able to map over time how the water quality in Long Island Sound is improving. And so that ultimately, those nuggets of what we've found from our research and a hands-on, tangible result that anyone can appreciate and respect and get excited about, if you're a boater, if you just want to go to the beach, those are the types of ways we try to make the connection between our research and anyone, regardless of age.
And for you, Greg, I would think it's so important to hammer home the message how the climate is changing, the planet is changing, and as a result, ecosystems are threatened and species are threatened. Is it a challenge to get that message across?
I echo what Tina said. It's for the students and the children. They seem to be getting it, which is very heartening for me because they're the ones that are going to be making those changes and helping this planet go forward. The programs that we have, the same thing. We have a CDC program, which is the Conservation Discovery Corps, which is made up of high school students. One of their tasks is to learn about conservation issues and environments, as going out into the field and doing work out there to improve habitat, remove invasive species, check on issues of global warming. So to watch those students just blossom, and we've done the program now for many years. It's one of my favorite programs at the zoo. We've done it for so many years now that we can now track some of our graduates from that program and learn that they've gone on into the field of environmental studies or into zoological fields. And so we know that this has made an impact on them. It's one of those, it's very much the analogy of the sea stars, how many sea stars can you throw in the ocean and make a difference? Well, maybe it just takes one. Mm-hmm. And so that is one of the things that it makes me feel really good. We have a trout in the classroom program where the students will, just a quick analogy, we've been working with the Pequannock River, same thing as Tina. Pequannock River runs through Bridgeport and empties in Long Island Sound, goes through six towns as it meanders its way down. We helped institute the Pequannock River Initiative, which has helped clean up that river. We helped put a fish ladder into Manel's Pond that has brought up alewives and blueback herring up into their natural spawning grounds. For 100 years, they weren't able to do that. We've been able to monitor that through with the and students to learn now that we have over 12,000 fish coming up that ladder, which is now added to the biomass of the river, to the health of the river. Now we have eagles we can observe eagles at the river, black crown night herons. We can observe ospreys fishing that area. So this type of research on getting this program going and then seeing the benefits is tremendous. And having those students actually be involved with it is great. Really quick with the analogy with the trout in the classroom, we were releasing brook trout back into the Quiet River, which actually extinct in that river for the last 100 years. And now we're finding adult brook trout in that river that are now surviving because of the work that's being done by the zoo and the towns and the students. And again, being a holistic program. And again, as Tina mentioned, sometimes it's just one little thing that can make that turn the tide.
And part of this is making this all fun, right, Tina?
Absolutely.
Exactly.
Tell us about some of the exhibits. Let's start with the Maritime Aquarium that are new, that are eye-catching, they're educational, and the kids are like, wow.
Yeah. So our newest exhibit is just about a year old, our newest permanent exhibit, I should say, and that's one called Just Add Water. And the inspiration behind Just Add Water is the oceans, and that oceans affect every single habitat, from the driest desert to the ocean itself. They are all influenced by oceans, and not everyone appreciates that. So we came up with a way to tell that story in an iterative fashion. So this exhibit basically has multiple habitats from the desert all the way through the rainforest, and you take a journey and see different animals and different habitats, and as you move along, there's slightly more water integrated into their habitat. So in the desert, water is just really there for consumption, and it's very modest. And then as you move to the grassland, there'll be some water, but it's not a marine or a heavily aquatic environment. And then ultimately in the rainforest, obviously that's an extreme amount of water that's part of it. And so it's a showcase of more terrestrial animals. So we have birds and monkeys and all sorts of interesting things that are a little bit surprising for guests at an aquarium. They expect everything to live under the water. So that's been a really fun way to bring to life a message that is very important to us, very important for people to hear, quite frankly, that, you know, ultimately respect the ocean because of all the power it has, but doing so in a really fun and engaging way that really holds their hand, so to speak, throughout the different habitats. My favorite is the macaw that's part of that exhibit. So,
and Greg, Tina just mentioned monkeys. You have a new habitat there at the zoo, the spider monkey habitat. Tell us about that.
Yeah, we've been working hard at the zoo to create new habitats for animals, and one of the things that we just opened up in the last few weeks was a spider monkey habitat. This is, again, as Tina mentioned, is fun for the kids. They get to see the animals, doing their natural behavior. We have graphics that explain where these animals come from and why they're endangered and why their habitat's endangered. We have interpretive interpreters there. Docents and our CDC kids are out there talking about the individual animals because we want to make that connection between the animal and the guest. And so far, it has been really, to me, a showstopper. It's really a lot of fun. I used to work with spider monkeys years ago when I first started working at the zoo. They have not been in the collection for quite a few years, so having them come back is gratifying to me. And it's also a bucket list item for me because this is the new habitat, is in the area where we used to have elephants at the zoo, and back in 1985, I eliminated those from the collection because zoo our size should not have things of that nature. Again, that's one of those evolutionary processes that you go through. You have to understand what you can take care of and why you're taking care of them. So our whole zoo is really going through looking at animals that are endangered from North America, South America, and cold weather Asia. The cold weather Asian side, we opened up last fall a red panda habitat. And the red panda habitat, again, is the same type of thing as the spider monkey, is that it's teaching people about these animals that come from cold weather areas that are also endangered. But one of the things that we're doing also as we're building these new habitats is giving the animals free choice. And this is something, again, as we talked about before, evolutionary between the animal care and our guests. Giving the animal free choice means on a hot day like today, the red pandas are not very happy about staying outside, and our guests are very happy to see them. So when we create these new habitats, we're creating them that you can see them inside and outside. An animal can transit through in the inside area to the outside area and back and forth at will whenever they want to, but still the guests can observe and see them and enjoy them and learn from them. So as we built the Red Panda, we do the same thing with the Spider Monkey, the same thing. They can go inside, outside at will. And as we go into the future, we're building a new Andy and Bear exhibits, and new tiger habitat coming up in the next year or so. Again, these things will all come to the same conclusion for the animal welfare and for the guests.
One thing I was going to mention to the two of you, the importance of new technologies and how you both are incorporating them. I mean, there's all kinds of new technologies.
We've been really choiceful about a high-end technology experience within the aquarium because we know it's part of people's lives and it can certainly bring a lot of mission-related things to life. Like, for example, we have a virtual reality humpback whale dive that you can do right now. But we're always trying to temper technology as additive and enhancement versus a distraction. Because at the end of the day, the living exhibits are what we want people to focus on. And we want, especially young people, those eyes to be up and looking around as opposed to eyes down. Yeah.
And Tina, we're out of time, but briefly, there's one quick thing you wanted to say.
Yeah, the only build is that we also are evolving our programs, that we're constantly trying to find ways to bring the animals more up close with the guests. So whenever an animal is comfortable, as Greg said, that we can bring them out from exhibit and have them even closer to the guests or any opportunity for a guest to be able to touch an animal. That just is another evolution that we think helps make it more fun and hands-on and engaging.
Yeah, that connection. We want to thank you so much, Tina, for joining us today from the Maritime Aquarium in Norwalk. Greg Dancho, always good to talk to you from the Beardsley Zoo in Bridgeport. Thank you both.
Becky, it's been too long. Hope to see you soon.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So we've taken a trip to the zoo and the aquarium in Connecticut. Now let's head out to Long Island. Kara Hahn joins us. She's Suffolk County legislator of Port Jefferson. She's also chair of the Committee on Parks and Recreation. Kara, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
In doing a little research, I'm a Connecticut-based girl, but doing a little research for this segment, I was so pleased to see the number of parks alone that are on Long Island.
We are really fortunate. We have an incredibly extensive park system, 46,000 acres in Suffolk County alone, in the Suffolk County park system. And then you add in state parks and village and town parks, and we really are fortunate where we live.
Right, and that doesn't even include the beaches, which is a whole other show. This is just inland with just the parks.
Yeah, we have 1,000 miles of waterfront in Suffolk County. So we are fortunate.
Let's talk a little bit about a park a day post on social media. What is that campaign?
So when I became parks chair several years ago, I think this might have been either the fourth or the fifth year of my A Park a Day in May, I decided to highlight a different park every day. I really have been very surprised in my travels around the county when I talk to people and they don't know about all the parks that we have. They don't know about what exciting adventures are in our own backyards. And so I've created several things to really get people involved and get people to visit our parks. We have a parks passport for kids. I started the Park a Day in May challenge, where every day in May on social media, I highlighted a different park in Suffolk County and challenged folks to go visit each and every one of them at some point during the summer.
And this is a real challenge for parks and rec departments, with kids so glued to the screens, to get them to look up and to enjoy nature, which is maybe not at first glance as exciting as a video game, but if you really take the time and you really take it all in, it can be.
Absolutely. There has been so much research out there that has shown that you get out into the outdoors, you get out into the environment, out into a forest or a park, and it reduces anxiety, it reduces stress, it can help with a whole host of factors that kids are facing today at rising levels. And especially obesity, if you just get out and walk a little bit, it can help with so many things. And so it really has been a challenge. But we have, you know, new and innovative ways to bring people in, and we really hope we can get the word out.
And one of those ways, which always cracks me up, is what we call glamping. Tell us a little bit about what Long Island has to offer when it comes to glamping.
Well, I know that New York State Parks has done a glamping experience on the North Fork. We have a glamping experience at Cedar Island County Park. And it's for those people who, you know, maybe a little squirmy about the thought of putting a tent down on the ground or don't really know how to drive a big RV, but want to experience our spectacular parks in a different way, in a comfortable bed with access to clean restrooms and, you know, running water.
Now we're talking.
So glamping, you know, is a different experience. It's a new experience, but one that I think Long Islanders, Suffolk County residents are really going to embrace.
That bridges the experiences.
Absolutely.
A new law was passed in June creating the Park Stewardship Pilot Program. You worked on that. Tell me a little bit about it.
Yes. Well, one of the problems with having 46,000 acres of parkland is that they have to be maintained and protected. And it's a struggle. We don't have the kind of staffing that's needed. There's no question about it that we have to increase staffing, but there's been some fiscal constraints on our budget in the recent years since the Great Recession. And so we are looking for new and innovative ways to just keep an eye on our parks. And I have increased access to a number of local parks, like added small parking lots and walking trails. But one of the things that happens when you do that is those trails need to be maintained. Those parking lots, the trash can accumulate. Sometimes trees fall over the trails and we don't know about it if it's not a park that's staffed. And so I had a local Boy Scout come to me, and he had taken an experience in the upstate Adirondack region with the New York State Park Rangers, and he came back and suggested we create a stewardship program where we have volunteer park stewards. And so I authored the legislation to create that program, and we're going to try it in 10 different parks. And what we expect to do is have the volunteer park steward to do weekly walks through the trails, to report back to the Parks Department on any litter that needs to be cleaned up or that they themselves cleaned up, on any clipping back of brambles that needs to happen, on any trees that might have fallen down along the pathway, any other vandalism or dumping. We've had a rash of dumping in our parks in Suffolk County. And if we have eyes and ears that feel responsible to be looking at a park that may not have full-time park staff present, it's a really good thing.
And I know there's also a new bike share program. Many of us don't think of riding bikes in some of these parks. Is that allowed, or where are these bikes able to, where do you pick them up, and where can they be used?
Yes, so right now, I don't know that they're certainly not in every park. We're working on the county executives folks and the Suffolk County Planning Department and the Economic Development Department are working on downtown locations. So sort of, I don't know if any of your listeners have been to New York City and seen City Bike, where there's a location where you can pick up a bike and drop off a bike. So we are working on establishing all of those locations, and we do certainly hope that in the downtowns where they're thinking of pulling up of creating these bike share locations, that they'll be near parks where they can also ride the bicycle.
You You know, I know one of the concerns here in Connecticut and Long Island that we face, and I think there's a new strain even that's been discovered on Long Island, of these tick-borne illnesses. What kind of advice do you have to those visitors who use the parks, who are going to be hiking on the trails, who maybe decide to go off-trail, so that they have a safe, healthy experience?
It is absolutely a problem here on Long Island, and it has been since I was a kid. I remember my mom doing nightly tick checks in my head after we would be playing in the backyard. So, you know, this has always been a problem on Long Island. I think it certainly has grown with, you know, the animals that carry the ticks, whether it be the mice or the deer. As they are living longer, as the winters are more mild, and there's an increasing problem. So people need to be vigilant about it. They need to be paying attention to what they're wearing. Light colors are best, long sleeves, long pants, putting your socks over your pants. If you're really going for a hike in the woods where it's not on a pathway that is either paved or you know, covered with gravel or something, where you really, you know, the brush is touching your legs, it's best to put your socks over your pants and wear light colors. And then do a check before you get in the car. Check over to see if there's anything visible. When you return home, check your clothes, take them off. The drier heat is the only thing that will kill ticks. So, you know, put your clothes in the washer, but then make sure they go into the dryer and on the high heat, and that should take care of it. And vigilance is best.
Yep. It sounds like a hassle, but you get used to it after a while.
Sure. It's part of, there are so many benefits to the outdoors.
That
outweigh the risk. And you know, certainly we're excited about so much, including the new Blue Way.
All right. Well, Kara Hahn of the Committee on Parks and Recreation in Suffolk County, thank you so much for joining us. Happy summer.
Thank you, Rebecca, for having me today.
Now with us is Kristen Jarnigan. She is the president and CEO of Discover Long Island. Kristen, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Big kudos to you. You came to this position about, 4 years ago and completely revamped it, rebranded it. I think it used to be called the Long Island Convention and Visitors Bureau and Sports Commission. Now you've got that much more engaging, shorter name. How did you make the transformation?
Yeah, thank you so much for acknowledging that. I did. I came just short of 4 years ago. I moved all the way from Arizona to Long Island, New York. I'd never been here before other than my interview. And it was a big undertaking, and that was quite the mouthful that our old name was, right? So we saved so much time just answering the phones alone as Discover Long Island. But it was something that I think happened when I came, being an outsider coming to Long Island and recognizing it for the tourism entity that it was. I really saw it from a visitor's perspective. I saw it for all of the incredible beauty and excitement and also some of the challenges that we face here as residents. And I think that's really important because a lot of things we take for granted in our own backyard where we live, and a lot of times we don't understand how visitors perceive our destination. So the first thing we did is we did a lot of research. We looked at who our customer was, what they like to do. We did a lot of consumer analysis. And based on that, we rebranded to Discover Long Island, which is more than a name. It's really a call to action for what we would like people to do when they visit us.
So who is your customer and what do they like to do?
So our customer, according to the data that we discovered, was primarily from the Northeast. They are mostly families. They are very educated and affluent. They like a soft adventure. They go on one foreign trip a year. They go on one theme park trip a year, typically. I mean, we know what kind of cars they drive. I could pretty much tell you the last time they bought a household small appliance. And we have this incredible data that we manipulate when we're looking to market or brand specific things that we have on Long Island, whether it's shopping or whether it's history or whether it's family. And we utilize this really cool software that we have to speak to them because we do have a very limited budget, and therefore our messaging and marketing needs to be very targeted and very concise.
All right, let's talk about some of the beautiful locations on Long Island and give our listeners at home some ideas for the rest of the summer and what they can do. I mean, some of the most beautiful beaches in the country are on Long Island. Tell us a little bit about them.
Absolutely. That's what we're known for. Long Island is really primarily known for our beaches, and we've historically, again, according to our research, been a summer, seasonal, weekend kind of destination. But we're looking to grow from that, and a lot of that is just letting people know, like we're doing today, so I appreciate it, letting people know all of the interesting and exciting and diverse things that we have to offer people on Long Island. So the beaches, I mean, hands down, are amazing, and they're a stone's throw from New York City. They're super easy to access through the Long Island Railroad, which has more than 124 stops along the island, so you don't even need a car. From Connecticut, you can take the ferries over and immediately be on one of our pristine beaches, which are regularly designated as the top in the world. And of course, you know, we're primarily known for the Hamptons, and as of late, we've become more known for our wine country on the North Fork. But I think what we're not as known for are the many different really vibrant downtowns, and that all have unique characteristics and history that are kind of sprinkled throughout all of Long Island.
You know, people get a sense of that when they do take the Port Jeff Ferry, and you get into Port Jefferson from Connecticut, and you're like, this is an adorable downtown area.
It really is adorable, and I think Long Island has long had a misperception of just being the Hamptons and the rest of it kind of feeling, you know, more like an urban area. But it's in fact true. We do feel more like New England, whether you're in the Northport or Huntington, or if you go on the South Shore. The South Shore tends to feel more, if you go to Long Beach, it feels to me, as an outsider, like Miami. I mean, everyone has, every inch of Long Island has kind of a unique characteristic, and there's so much to explore, as well as history. I mean, a lot of people don't realize that the Culper spy ring that inspired the very famous series called Turn all took place on the North Shore of Long Island, and you can kind of follow along where the spies lived and how they helped George Washington win the Revolutionary War, which is just one of our unique focuses on history. The other thing that's really kind of relevant right now is the Apollo 11 anniversary. People don't realize that every single one of the lunar modules were made right here on Long Island, and all the astronauts came and trained here before they went to the moon, and you can actually experience that exhibit right now at the Cradle of Aviation. So there's so many hidden gems to talk about here.
And not to mention the great Gatsby-style mansions that dot the coastline.
The Great Gatsby, and we keep saying 2020 is really going to be a very popular year for Long Island because you're going to see a resurgence of the Roaring Twenties. And the Great Gatsby mansions are so beautiful. You can tour many of them that have been restored. You can stay in one of the most famous ones, Ohiki Castle, which is also where Taylor Swift filmed her Blank Space video. That's what it's most known
for
today.
Didn't
know that. And on Jones Beach on the South Shore, they actually just came up with a brand new restaurant and venue called Gatsby on the Ocean, which is ocean views. And there's just constant new renovations taking place. There's also a brand new exhibit that just opened last week called Dinosaurs at the Tanglewood Preserve. And this is animatronic and amazing dinosaurs that people can go see. And you would never know it was in the middle of this kind of residential neighborhood. But it's a wonderful exhibit that as you're kind of touring through Long Island, not to pass by the small towns that you drive through to get to the beach. There's so much to see and do along the way.
And very, very briefly, there's so much about agriculture on Long Island. You don't think about it, but there's pick-your-own farms. Tell us really briefly, Lavender by the Bay sounds beautiful.
Lavender by the Bay is very famous, and it's you feel like you're in the south of France, but it just actually just embarked on sweet corn season as well. So every season there's different vegetables and crops that you can come and pick and enjoy and just savor, and it's beautiful farm country, and we welcome people all year round to see what we have to offer.
Well, congratulations on your new role, your new rebranding efforts. It sounds like it's paying off, and we appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you so much. Always appreciate being on the show.
Okay, and that's it for our show today. Thank you to our guests and to you, our listeners. You've been listening to The Full Story. I'm Rebecca Saran.